Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to the Taylor Healing TV podcast. I'm your host, Taylor DeClue, oracle, author, and founder of the Taylor Healing Collective. This is the space where mysticism, technology, and sovereignty converge. Every episode is a transmission designed to help you decode the world around you and reclaim your power within it. So, take a deep breath and tune in. The transmission begins now. Okay, hello and welcome to Tailored Healing TV. I'm your host, Taylor DeClue. The show is dedicated to helping people understand the systems that govern their daily lives, especially the ones that are invisible. In the digital age, our phones, apps, and connected devices are not just tools. They've become governing environments. So most people don't realize that a surveillance-based business model now shapes our daily lives. We have data extraction that's replaced informed consent. Technology is being used to quietly influence decisions, beliefs, and even opportunities. So the question we're asking today is straightforward. Are we still in control, or are we being controlled without realizing it? So I am going to let our guest today, Rex Lee, let him introduce himself just a little bit. I got the opportunity to meet him at a panel that I was asked to sit on a couple of weeks ago, and I thought that he would be the perfect guest to come in and start giving us a little bit of insight into this story behind cybersecurity, behind the internet, and the current day matrix that we all live in. So Rex, could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you?
Yes, my name is Rex Lee, and thank you, Taylor, for having me on your program. I come out of tech, so I'll give you just a quick bio. I started off in the tech and telecommunications industry in 1983, when back in the paging days or beeper days, and I was on the front end and the back end of the business bell curve in radio paging. Then in the 90s, the company I worked for off and on for over 30 years, Carnegie Technologies, we launched two cellular phone carriers that we built out and sold to AT&T ultimately. Along the way, we also opened up an enterprise app and platform development company that was a little notorious at the time. It was called HoudiniSoft. And we built reverse logistics platforms for Metro PCS, Cricket, Verizon, and other telecommunication carriers. And one of the main features within HoudiniSoft allowed for what we call in the industry unlocking and provisioning. Now, the street term for that is jailbreaking and flashing at an enterprise level. So we didn't build the platforms for the public, we built them for the carrier. So back in 2008 to 2013 timeframe, if you walked into a Metro PCS store and you had a Verizon phone and you saw a Metro flash, that was HoudiniSoft. It would unlock that Verizon phone and they could flash it on their network in less than 3 minutes. And it was through HoudiniSoft that I got into cybersecurity, because basically we were labeled the world's largest legal hacking firm. And that's when we were able to get into all these. At that time, you had GSM, TDMA, CDMA. This is all pre-LTE. And then LTE was coming on at that same time in 2008 timeframe. What we wrote was an algorithm that would unlock at that time over 600 makes and models of flip phones and then the smartphones that were just coming on the market. And in our labs, we were able to expose all the vulnerabilities in the Android OS, Apple iOS and Microsoft Windows operating systems. So we were, we were everybody came after us when they found out that we were enterprise and not Cheeto-stained fingered hackers in our mother's bat basements unlocking phones with a PST tool, that this was enterprise. It threatened the industry at the time, because when the iPhone first came out, for you youngsters out there, I'm starting to feel a little old, there were exclusivity deals being cut with the carriers, meaning that you could only get your iPhone from AT&T. At that time, when Galaxies came on, you could only get a Galaxy from Verizon. And they were cutting out the smaller carriers at that time. There were at one point there were over 40 cellular phone companies in America, and they were cutting out the small people. This is before telecom centralization occurred, which happened when LTE came out, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But at that time, Houdini became a threat to the industry. There were no more exclusive deals. You could buy your iPhone from AT&T, or you can buy a Galaxy from Verizon and go flash it on Metro's network. That destroyed that model. So everybody came after us. The CTIA is the governing body of wireless, and at that time, that included T-Mobile, Sprint, AT&T, and Verizon. And they all came after us. Apple, Google, they all thought this was a threat to their business models as well. So they, in turn, also came after us as well. And they tried to make it illegal for consumers to unlock their cell phones or their tablet PCs or their computers in 2009 through the 2009 Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So they tried to make this illegal. And this is re relevant to the discussion we're about to have. So we work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. And we were able to help write the arguments against Apple, Google, AT&T, CTIA, the whole tech and telecom industry for the 2009 Digital Millennium Copyright Act for the Library of Congress. So we wrote the technical arguments against their arguments because they were trying to make it illegal and lock everybody out of their computers and their phones over these exclusive deals. Well, in 2009, our arguments were upheld by the Library of Congress, and we won the argument, and that made it legal for the consumer to be able to plug their cable into their devices and unlock them. This is what when you brought up earlier that we're being controlled, and it's a silent measure of control. Nobody sees this control going on. This was the genesis of that. And through the Houdini labs, I was able to learn all the be able to learn all the vulnerabilities in these operating systems, and that led me into cybersecurity. And the need for Houdini disappeared in 2013, which is a key year. That's when LTE unified everything, and you didn't need algorithm to unlock the locks on the phones anymore. You could use a passcode to unlock them. So that's how I got started, and that's how I got to where I am. And then we can discuss a little bit further my work in cybersecurity. Plus, I'm an advocate for an electronic bill of rights.
Thank you, Rex. Oh, first, I have a couple things I want to say in between our questions. One is thank you for your work, and I consider it to be wisdom and something that is very much needed amongst different audiences around the world to understand their data, how it works, how it was built. And then another thing I wanted to say was the name Houdini Soft is so interesting because these are unseen systems and hidden systems. So the fact that you're working with a company that had that name, it's as though you were already very well versed in being able to see what others cannot. And to me, that's a little bit like reading binary code in the Matrix, getting to see behind the program. So thank you for your work. So one of the first questions I want to get into with you is what first alerted you to the scale of personal data harvesting behind the scenes? What was the first moment that you had to kind of like seen that there's a vulnerability in these systems and inspired you to start working with them?
So if you go back to the 90s, people didn't realize that, at that time, if you wanted a web browser, it either came pre-installed on your computer or you purchased it. It was a paid-for product. At that time, a new company toward the mid to late 90s, Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, started. And So at first, everybody was shocked that this free web browser was going to be used by everybody on the internet. It was free. It was way more powerful than any other web browser. It really was. It was great. It's new technology. It's free, but nothing is free. How did this company, how would, what, first of all, what type of company is this? Is this a technology company? And what were they expecting by giving away a free product because nothing is free? So early on, when I started looking at that business model of giving something away free, well, what in return are you giving up that they're going to make money? And that's when I realized that this company was not a tech company, but they were actually a data broker that was utilizing technology as a vehicle to collect information off of their end users by giving away a free product. So if you understood that, and really my first understanding of that was diving into what was I agreeing to when I clicked on I agree to use their product. Well, they simply tell you, we're going to collect all the information and we're going to monetize it and you're going to get nothing in return, but we're giving away a free product. So I used it. It didn't bother me back then. I used it. I was getting something free in return. Then it amped up a little bit more in the early 2000s with Apple's connected iPod. Same thing. Now they first of all, when the first iPods came out, they weren't connected. But when they connected it, they had their own operating system, iOS, and it was on an iPod first. And again, what am I getting with this? Well, it went from me just giving up whatever I'm searching for so that Google can package that and sell it to advertisers. That's how they make their money. I understood they were a data broker. Apple is a consumer manufacturer of products. And now, what can you do with this iOS? Well, that became a great thing in my mind because I love music and they were collecting some data on me and exposing me to more music choices. So as a consumer. But then when it proliferated from an iPod and a free web browser to a phone that's a computer, because a smartphone isn't just a phone, it's a computer and a phone. Well, imagine how powerful of a company can you become if you can surveil and data mine people by way of their telephones and their computers? That's when I wanted to not walk, but run away from this because that's an intrusion into your privacy. So it was the evolution of the free web browser to the connected iPod. And in between, if you want to look at MySpace, you have social media on the rise. At that point, you're getting a free social media account, and then Facebook came on, you're getting stuff free at that point. Well, now it's proliferating to products that you purchase, and they're products of necessity, like a phone and a computer. And then I kept thinking of all of the information that they could collect. So I actually retained using my BlackBerry at that time because BlackBerry devices were completely private. They weren't supported by a targeted advertising business model or a business model rooted in surveillance capitalism. But it was through the evolution of the web browser to the operating systems that supported phones and computers.
Thank you for that explanation. It's so intricate how fast that we have gone through all of these systems without a really firm understanding of how they work. So thank you for explaining that. And I think that's going to give the audience just a little bit more insight into the different steps of evolution that this has gone through, because I was a millennial. I grew up first home computer, I think when I was about 9 or 10 years old, which had to be probably about, I don't even know, about 1999, in between that time and 2003. So in 2025, getting to see that evolution, that's very interesting. One of the next questions I had for you is that can you describe, I guess, your personal insight between big tech companies and US intelligence agencies?
Well, first of all, you call them big tech, right? If you recollect a few minutes ago when I looked at Alphabet, they didn't start out a tech company. They're not a tech company. They started out a data broker. And this explanation of who they are will lead into why, we'll talk a little bit about government collusion here in a second with what people term as big tech companies. They never were a tech company. Sanjay Kelly and some of the other founders of Google, they wanted to be a data broker like LexisNexis and compete against LexisNexis and collect as much data on people. Well, at that time, the internet was just coming out, and what a better way to collect information on people than through the web browser. So I don't know, I wasn't there, but I heard this may or may not be true, but I heard they named the company Alphabet because they wanted to dominate every industry by the letter of the alphabet. And the way they could do that was through a web browser, then later on, an operating system that would data mine people by way of their phones and their computers. And then you have to understand they started out to this very day, they're a data broker that utilizes technology as a vehicle to surveil and data mine people for profits. Apple evolved into a data broker to compete against Google. A lot of people don't realize this, but Eric Schmidt left Apple to become the CEO of Google. And him and Steve Jobs had a big falling out because there went the IP for the Android OS was evolved from iOS. And that made Steve Jobs to the day he died, he wanted to put Google out of business over there was a rift with Eric Schmidt involved in that, but they evolved. Later on, Microsoft to compete had to evolve. So they changed the architecture of Windows to that of the same architecture that iOS is built on and Android's built on. And that is an open application programmable interface that allows the apps to interlock with each other and collect data off of your phone, your computer, or any device that's supported by Android, iOS, and Windows. And they too evolved into a data broker. So when you say big tech, I'm thinking big data. They are the biggest data brokers in the world, and the government knows this. And so, heck yes, it was exposed by Edward Nord, Edward Snowden that there was collusion between these so-called tech companies, I call them data brokers, and the government. That was exposed by Prism and confirmed. It was always somewhat a rumor, but Edward Snowden confirmed this. So thus was born what I call the industrial tech complex, meaning that everything that's being data mined off your phone, even though you're told it's for targeted advertising purposes, was ending up in the government's hands by one way or another. So that the rather than these companies being an intelligence agency directly for the government, they're an intelligence agency by proxy to not only our government, but all governments around the world, including adversarial regimes or adversarial countries like China and Russia, because they're colluding with those governments as well and sharing information as well.
Makes you rethink the way that we use these words and these phrases because your explanation of them being data brokers made me look at it in a different light. There's just a certain elitism in the conversation when we use the terms big tech, but when I think of them as a broker, I see them completely different. Would
Exactly. So when I speak to audiences, I let them know that. I literally ask the audience. I do talks on this all over the world, and I ask the audience how many. I'll list out these companies, and I ask them how many people in here think these are tech companies, and mostly everybody raises their hand. Then I tell them, no, they're data brokers, and I do that exactly to get the same reaction that you're having now, so that people put them properly in their context. They're not consumer manufacturers only. They're part of what they do is tech, but how they're valued on Wall Street. And when you look at these trillion-dollar valuations, that has nothing to do with new innovation. It has everything to do with how much information they can collect off of their paying customers because this business model proliferated from free products and services such as a social media account and a web browser to products that we pay for, our smartphones, our cars, our connected TVs, our connected appliances, our computers. They all cost money. So now we're paying for these products and we're paying a monthly subscriber fee, and they're collecting all of that data through new innovation. So when you see a new operating system come out, it's a new way to collect information from you. When you see an upgrade or a new innovation such as AI come out, it's a new form and a faster way and a more efficient way to collect the information from you. And that's where you see the valuations of these companies balloon up from 50 billion, 100 billion, 500 billion. Now you're seeing trillion-dollar valuations. Has nothing to do with their new fancy product. It's what their fancy product can do, which is collect as much information off of the paying customer and the end users, which include children and teens, that they can package and sell. And they don't have to compensate you for the trillions of dollars that they're making from advertising. So it's all about targeted advertising, aside from the fact that they can package this data and sell it to nebulous third parties. So you'll see in the terms of use, you'll see like we share this information with our trusted partners. Well, that trusted partner can be the United States government, or it can be the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party. Anybody can buy the data from.
That's probably the most honest explanation I've heard of it, and it gives us a real insight, not into the way that we're just consuming data, but the way we're being used through that as well. So, can an American citizen or any citizen really avoid being tracked or profiled today?
So what's happened? No, it's virtually impossible if you want to use connected products of necessity. A TV, a smartphone, a computer, anything supported by Android, iOS, or Microsoft Windows. All of these three operating systems have one thing in common before you even start using the apps. And the apps have one thing in common. And the developers of the operating systems, Google, Apple, and Microsoft, plus the developers of the apps, Meta, ByteDance, which is the parent company to TikTok, Amazon, X, any app out there that you want to utilize, they all have one thing in common. They require you to click on I agree. And if you don't agree, you can't participate either using the app or you can't even use the products that you paid for. These are called one-way contracts of adhesion that force participation. So, yeah, you don't have to participate, but you're not going to be able to participate in internet trade and commerce on a global basis. You won't be able to participate. You won't have access to it, because what has happened since the evolution of LTE and only having not multiple protocols like CDMA, GSM, and all these TDMA and all these other protocols that the other cellular phone carriers were on. Once that consolidated, then that opened the door for what I term as internet centralization.
Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Okay, so internet centralization is, everybody tells me, hey, Rex, the internet's not centralized. I can go on my website, I can go to any website and type in www.facebook.com. Is that what people do anymore? No. What has happened is there's only three on-ramps to the internet. And those three on-ramps are iOS, Windows, or Android. Those are the three highways. They're controlled by three companies. So every device in the world, whether they're sold in China or the United States, that operates off of those devices, the operating system that support those devices, those are the three on-ramps that you choose to connect to the internet. Every one of those companies have the same business model. They are supported by predatory surveillance and data mining business practices rooted in surveillance capitalism. So that means no matter what product you buy, as long as it's supported by those three operating systems, you're going to be forced to participate, or you can't utilize the products that you purchase. So you're forced into this. Now, I'm very controversial. I talk about two things. I talk about digital colonialization and cyber enslavement. So when I talk about the I agree, I got to click on I agree. I call that actually a cyber enslavement agreement. And I've written articles about this dating back to 2018, 19 timeframe. Actually, I've been writing articles about surveillance capitalism since 2016, 17 timeframe. But that's how they get you is through a contract of adhesion attached to a consumer connected product of necessity. You have to have a smartphone today or you can't participate. You can't connect to the internet and sell anything without developing an app in iOS, Android, or Windows, or all three. Otherwise, you can't distribute your product. So Google, Apple, and Microsoft, I call them the Gambinos, the Corleones, and the Sopranos. If you don't kiss their ring, you cannot have access to internet trade and commerce. And that's how they centralized the internet, was through the monopolization of the operating system market and the global development and distribution of AI-infused apps, social media platforms, and other AI and quantum-driven systems of today and tomorrow all have to be developed in Android, iOS, or Windows. So you're forced to play the game as technology evolves, and those three companies are in control of access to global internet trade and commerce.
So, what would the common person be shocked to learn about how their data affects their opportunities if every system is attached to it, and employment, credit, even healthcare, or access to information in general?
Well, we've seen it. If you dissent, you get deplatformed. And we've seen it with people, whether you're on one side of the political aisle or the other, that text or that tweet that you did 10 or 15 years ago somehow crops up as you become, if you dissent and you move up in society and you get to a point where you can become a threat to the system, that old text is going to come out. That old tweet is going to come out and derail you. We've actually seen this. When Parler was becoming a threat to Twitter because Twitter was engaging in censorship of legitimate news stories and everybody was leaving, it was called Twexit. The powers that be, Parler's not one of the canonized companies, X or Twitter was at the time. What'd they all do? Amazon got together with Google, Apple, and Microsoft, the Corleones, the Gambinos, and the Sopranos, and they deplatformed them and destroyed their business, not because of January 21st or January 6th, because of the riots. That was just the smokescreen excuse. Twitter was hemorrhaging all of their subscribers there, and they were losing control of the narrative of news and messaging. So they made up an excuse and deplatformed a company, and that was it. That was the end of their competition. So not only can they take your old data and harm you with it, but they can actually exile you. They no longer have to literally, if you want to look at it from a higher level, they no longer have to commit mass genocide of anybody or dissenters anymore. They can just deplatform them and exile them from the internet and marginalize them. And then there goes all your financial opportunities, your opportunities to move up in society. And we've seen it. We actually have witnessed. There are far more examples of this. The banks are starting to do it, where they'll deplatform somebody financially. Because of their political views or whatever. So this is a dangerous thing. And as we start to digitize our currency, then now we're losing our financial sovereignty. We've already lost privacy. We've already lost our data sovereignty. We're going to lose our financial sovereignty because then you have full control over populaces and society.
Well, not all of my audience knows, but some of them do. I was deplatformed myself from TikTok, and one of the last posts that I made was about metadata and some discoveries that I made. So I have firsthand had experience in that. However, I encourage anyone who is making a platform of their own, shifting into any kind of entrepreneurial ventures, or even like Rex writing and speaking out about these things publicly to protect others. Do not give up the fight because this has been predicted. It's been shown for a very long time, and not in a conspiracy way, but in a very serious shift in our economic state as well as our overall well-being as humans. So that's just something that's close to my heart because it just happened a couple of months ago, but we're still building. And having this information gives you insight. And in this next portion that we're going to go into, Rex is going to tell us a little bit about the Electronic Bill of Rights. So we can learn a little bit how we can become more empowered in this. So can you tell us a little bit about the Electronic Bill of Rights, why you
Yeah.
decided to start it, and why it's needed right now?
Well, deplatforming is something we have in common, and that did it for me. I was actually deplatformed by Microsoft back in 2022, I think it was, whenever we were getting out of Afghanistan. As you know, I'm a tech journalist. If people want to an internet search on Rex Lee and Epic Times or Rex Lee NTD News and China in Focus, or other publications that I do work for. I'm a freelancer, so I do work for many other publications. You'll find me on the internet. So in 2022, this is when it hit home for me. I was deplatformed because when we were getting out of Afghanistan, I went on the State Department website to see what form Americans in country had to fill out to repatriate back to the United States, as well as Afghan who supported us and were also informers and so forth, interpreters. They all had to get out safely. Well, on the this is the God's honest truth, on the State Department's website was a Microsoft Forms, not a form attached to a State Department computer behind the government's firewall. It was a free form from Microsoft, and it was asking for your name, address, phone number, family members, everything. And in the Microsoft Forms terms of use, like all of them, they don't provide any indemnity. So if the forms were hacked, it became a kill list. And I put that out not only on my feed, but I'm also a member of the intelligence feed because I'm a former advisor for DHS and NSA on threats associated with tech-based hybrid warfare, which is another topic we could talk all day long about. But I put it out there, and other journalists picked up on it, and it became a nationwide story about a kill list. And I think Fox was one of the first ones to promote it. And when the State Department or the government, I don't know who, when they caught wind of it, I tried to get back on Microsoft and I was totally deplatformed. I had over 10 years of post on there. Everything was erased. I was erased from the face of the earth. And all the other journalists, I have a big following with journalists, everything I had posted disappeared from their feeds. Everything. It was as if Rex Lee never existed. And some journalists all got together and said, hey, he's a professional journalist. So long story short, it took about 2 months for me to get back onto Microsoft. And get back onto LinkedIn. And that's when I got serious about it. But in 2017, I was asked by Senator Ted Cruz's office, based on some information that I had submitted to the Department of Homeland Security, Science and Technology, and the NSA. And also, I was an advisor for other members of Congress for big tech hearings that you at that time were going on, which was Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and Google. Business data collection business practices with Sundar Pichai and Mark Zuckerberg. And what I was doing is I was working with the senators and the House of Representatives staffers on what questions they should ask these guys because they don't know how these apps or these platforms work. And I do because I come out of the industry. I'm an app and platform developer at the highest level. So I was giving them all the questions. And Ted Cruz's office got back to me, one of the staffers, and said, hey, can you write, if you were to articulate what was needed to change in technology for new legislation, can you write a congressional policy change proposal for us? And I did. I didn't call it the Electronic Bill of Rights at that time, but I started to write this stuff down, and then it came out. I said, you know what? There's a need for an Electronic Bill of Rights. This is in 2017. I provided to them in 2018 and 19, I think it was. I actually wrote a two-part article for the Epic Times based on the need for an electronic bill of rights. So they're inlaid the foundation for what it's evolved into today, that we do need legislation to change this. It's not going to change. The companies aren't going to give up their trillion-dollar valuations to change this. It has to change through legislation. And that's what I learned. And I submitted it in 2017 and never heard back from Ted Cruz's office because later on it came out that he was one of the politicians that was caught up in the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal along with Donald Trump. So needless to say, they looked at that and said, no, we don't want the consumer to have this much power because there goes government collusion and big tech and their ability to collect all this data on us.
So, which protection do you see in the Electronic Bill of Rights as the highest priority for a citizen?
The elimination of surveillance capitalism through forced participation through contracts of adhesion. You got to get rid of, you can't sell me a computer and force me into a business model I don't want anything to do with. And don't give me these phony, we give you this privacy dashboard and all that, because when the operating systems upgrade, the surveillance defaults always go back. You have to stay on top of it. They're laborious. If you've ever set privacy settings on your devices, you'll notice occasionally they'll reset, or you got to go back and as you add in more apps or they update everything, just it's too laborious. It should be a simple one click. I want to participate or I don't want to participate, and that's it. But you shouldn't be held. That shouldn't be held against you to where you can't use your product. That's where they have us. You can disagree, but then you've got a brick for a computer. If you can disagree, you got a brick for a phone. You can disagree. Your car may be able to get you from point A to point B, but good luck. You won't have any access to your radio or other components if you disagree with the terms in the car. So they're forcing us into this. And that's why I go back to cyber enslavement through one-way contracts of adhesion. That needs to change because a long time ago, people used to tell me, losing privacy is no big deal. And I tell them, we haven't lost privacy. We're being exploited for profits at the expense of our privacy, safety, security, and so forth. People ask me, well, why do you say safety? Well, there's this little thing that they hook you with once you agree to be exploited for profits. Then they put a line of coke out there for you in the form of addictive technology. These apps are developed with what's called brain hijacking technology. This is a real technology. It's brain hijacking technology associated with manipulative advertising technology, and they're built into the apps. It's little things like social validation feedback loops or intermittent variable rewards. People don't know why that they scrolled. Why is it you scroll downward on your phone? Like when you have your phone, you got to scroll downward. Well, it's the same brain hijacking technology that's built into slot machines. The mind sees something rolling down, and then there's this intermittent variable reward, and then you add in notifications, and then you add in a divisiveness in the algorithm. So if you do step away from the addictive technology to have some free time, it's going to reach out to you with a notification and draw you back in. And it could be a notification based on divisiveness to get you into an argument, to play on your ego, your pride, your emotions, and so forth. That's built in. With AI, it's gotten even worse. There's a manipulative technology that's called the ELIZA effect. It's the humanization of AI. This was discovered by Joseph Weizenbaum, an MIT AI researcher, when he was doing some work at Stanford University in 1966. They developed the first AI chatbot and they called it ELIZA. And of course, they didn't have the text-to-voice technology that we do today, but they had connected computers that students who participated in the program were communicating with it, and they wanted to use it as a psychologist And so they figured that students would open up more if they weren't face to face with somebody, and they were right. But along the way, they said, oh my God, you can actually brainwash people and indoctrinate people with political ideology and a whole lot of other horrifying things. Basically, instead of the Manchurian candidate, you would turn people into the Manchurian voter if this were in the wrong hands. So later on, Joseph Weizenbaum wrote a Book of Ethics in 1975, exposing what the ELISA effect is, and that through AI ethics, this should be outlawed. Well, that's been all adopted by all these companies. They're making cute avatars and so forth. So if you were to look at what's going on in technology today, you've got to ban the contracts of adhesion, but equally, you've got to get rid of this addictive technology. It's brainwashing technology is what it is. And those would be the two first things that I would key in on.
Thank you for speaking to that because I always do question this nature of human behavior since technology has grown more and more prevalent in household. It's unavoidable at this point for most people in their homes, but also this addictiveness, how it shapes decisions in their everyday lives when it comes to interacting with demographics or political decisions or financial decisions at that, and how it's shaping people kind of in this state of unawareness and bliss. So when you used even the term about the Manchurian voter, that was the first thing that popped in my head. I was thinking of the Manchurian candidate and how people are reacting and responding to this as well. So have you experienced any obstacles with this from corporations or governments or economic interests?
Yes. Well, my career in tech blew up when I went public after Houdini Soft. I was actually, I was the first person in the world to discover pre-installed Chinese technology in a mainstream smartphone. It was the Galaxy Note. Back in the Android Jelly Bean OS days, this is 2013 timeframe. This is ancient times. But after Houdini Soft, I went to work as a consultant. And one of my first clients was a defense contractor, and I reverse engineered at that time I still had my BlackBerry, and everything that I knew from Houdini Soft, this defense contractor had a BYOD program, bring your own device. So he had Android and iOS users, and I wanted to see if a Galaxy Note was safe to use in a confidential and protected environment. And that's when I discovered this technology. If I could do screen share, I can actually show you it, because this was another
Please.
pinnacle moment. This is from 2000. This is from 2013 timeframe, 14 timeframe. I didn't know I discovered pre-installed Chinese technology at that time.
I'm such a pioneer.
So I'll pull it up here. So can you see this?
Yes, I can see it.
How about now? Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, what you're looking at is below the BIOS. I won't get into a lot of technical terms. I ran the world's largest legal hacking firm, trust me. This is called an interactive application permission command string. And this is relevant to your question, have I had a falling out not only with my career, but also government agencies and so forth. When I reverse engineered this phone, I got underneath the BIOS and I start pulling up these command strings. I didn't know what they were at the time. Android permission Baidu location services. It was attached to the 4.2 email app that integrated your corporate email. This had nothing to do with Baidu or Google. This was the app that, if I worked for Exxon, Rex Lee at Exxon.com, my email, corporate email, would be integrated through this app, which makes it even more dangerous. The app could not be turned off, nor could I uninstall the app. And the permission is android.permission/baidu_location/services. This meant that Baidu was able to track location services through this app. And I was able to, these are the actual screenshots from this. This is the 4.2 app. This was Jelly Bean OS. So I didn't know what that was. So later on, I was at UTC event in Austin, and I met a Department of Homeland Security representative who spoke there, and he said, if you see something, say something. This is the utility industry, critical infrastructure. And I showed him that I'd discovered this in a Galaxy Note. Well, he had a Galaxy Note, and his name was John McClane. I kid you not, just like Die Hard. So he was a DHS agent, and I actually pulled it up on his phone. And he told me that Google gave the government a hardened Android OS with no data mining or targeted advertising. It was a government-issued device. And at first argued with me and said that my finding would never be on his phone, and I pulled it up on his phone. And long story short, he asked me for the report. I gave him the report that I did for Space Data, the defense contractor that I reverse engineered the device on the four. And he took that back to Washington. I didn't hear from them for like 6 months. And then I got a call from David Nolan, the head of DHS Science and Technology at the time. And he asked me if I could participate as an advisor for the 2017 DHS S&T study on mobile device security. And I said I would. And he said, well, the reason we're asking you is we spent the last 6 months trying to debunk your findings, and we could not debunk any of them. And we gave your findings to Google, Samsung, and T-Mobile where I bought the phone. So they flew me out to Menlo Park, and I met with the government in Menlo Park, right? Where all the headquarters are, Alphabet, Meta, and so forth. And all of those people were in the room, and they wanted to know who I was. And then they finally put it together. They looked at me and they said, one of them, I think it was a representative from Google, and he said, that's Rex Lee of Houdini Soft. He ran the world's largest legal hacking firm. He's legit. I guess they wanted to see if I was a threat because nobody had gotten that low in the BIOS. Over a 4 month period, I had went through millions of lines of code, like you said, seeing the matrix. What you that line that you see in the matrix where all the code is dropping from the, that's one piece of the code. Android dot permission, Baidu dot location services. That's called an SDK piggyback code that allows two or more companies to surveil you and data mine you from a single app. It's the most horrifying thing ever. Because that means if you have all apps from Google and you say you trust Google, that means they're allowing companies from China to pay them $1 billion to get the same information off that app, but you don't know how many companies or governments could be involved in this. So that's what I had discovered was an SDK piggyback code in the device and had no idea what it was. A friend of mine who looked at it said, Baidu's a company from China. I didn't know who they were. He goes, you just discovered Chinese surveillance technology in this phone, and that's the code. So they, after the report came out, I wrote an analysis of their report. They retracted, I mean, they did not include my findings of the Chinese surveillance technology and the 2017 study on mobile device security, plus all the other threats associated with surveillance capitalism, apps from China that pose threats, a national security threat to the United States. I had all this, I wrote all this stuff up, and they excluded almost everything from the report. But I'm in the report. RML Business Consulting is listed as a participant in the port in the report, but they excluded everything, and I slammed them for it. And then said everything that I gave to them. And before I met with them, I sent my findings and my report to Google and told them I was going to meet with DHS and I wanted to make sure everything that I found in that operating system was true. They never also pushed back either directly with me. And once I knew everything was legit, I went public with it. And that was it. Now and through word in the government, the NSA reached out to me. They actually flew to one of my speaking events, and I showed that code up on the screen. And after I got off stage, they contacted me through email, and the NSA said, "Can you share your smartphone report with us that you shared with DHS?" And I shared it with them. And then later on, I became a advisor for not only Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, but I was advising Congress on big tech hearings all the way through the Meta whistleblower hearings with Francis Haugen through 2022. And I was giving the government all of this information on addictive technologies, the contracts of adhesion, threats posed by Chinese surveillance apps, which is tied to tech-based hybrid warfare. And all along the way, they kept not, they were not enforcing anything. They weren't doing it. In other words, the government with hard evidence, with code, pictures of code. I'm the first person to come out and show the world the code. They didn't want anything that they're getting paid. And this goes back to lobbying, which is a whole nother topic that we have to discuss down the road, but it's the tech lobby. Everything is being controlled through K Street law firms, and they're covering everything up. Now, as far as addictive technology, I wasn't the first person to expose that. There's a guy named Tristan Harris, who was a former product manager for Google. He was the first one to start to expose this back in the 2014 timeframe. He went public on 60 Minutes. And then there's another gentleman who also is an advocate, Jonathan Haidt, and they're only addressing a symptom of the problem. All they do is address the addictive technology side of it. They're not addressing the business side of it, the money. And that's the difference between their advocacy and my advocacy, is I'm trying to kill the business model, because if you don't kill the money, it's never going to end.
Very wise, and it makes me view this whole situation kind of as a monster of its own creation. It's something eating something else, eating something else. And I've even seen a few funny advertisements of companies like NVIDIA and OpenAI all feeding each other's pockets at the same time. So it's making those funny videos make sense a lot more now.
Well, if I don't want to sound like a grandfather, but I used to watch the Three Stooges, and there's a skit on the Three Stooges. And I'll give you a perfect analogy of when NVIDIA cuts a deal with OpenAI, and then they cut a deal with Meta and so forth. Well, there's a skit where Moe, Larry, and Curly are walking down the street, and Curly bends over and he picks up and he finds a $20 bill. And then Moe goes, "Hey, you owe me $20." And he takes the $20 bill from Curly. Then Larry says, "Hey, Moe, you owe me $20." And then Curly goes, "Hey, you owe me $20." So the $20 bill ends up back in Curly's hands, but everybody's paid off. They paid their debt off with the same money. They're
It's
not
pretty
producing
wild.
anything
That's
new.
such wild that we see this happening, and it's comical but very serious at the
Oh,
same
yeah, it
time.
is.
It just gives you a different perspective.
Well, they're baking the books for, look, they're not generating any wealth from all this AI development. You can't. When you have to overcome trillions of dollars in debt, and money that you've borrowed, and money that's come from investors, with a new product that you're out there, there's only so much targeted advertising that you can profit from. You'll never be able to recover that. So the only way they could do this is through baking the books, stocks, and building this bubble. And as soon as the bubble bursts, we're going to be told they're all too big to fail, and then you or I are going to end up paying the bill on all this. And that's what we see going on. And this goes back to the lobby. So I wondered, in 2022, I stopped being a advisor for. I've been asked time and time again, "Hey, can we get your thoughts on this?" No, I'm not advising government anymore, not the U.S. government. I've actually been working with foreign governments, mostly EU members and governments in Africa through Smart Africa, and I've been working with them on AI and tech compliance, tech governance, AI and tech governance. Which is the Electronic Bill of Rights, because they're open to it. They want data and privacy sovereignty because their countries are being exploited. It's not just individuals. This is where digital colonialism comes in. They're being exploited. Not only are their citizens being exploited for profits, but you have trillions of dollars in targeted advertising that's being made from global profits, yet none of these profits are ever taxed. So that means that the data is the most valuable resource on the planet, more valuable than gold. It's being mined from the citizens, who are turned into uncompensated information producers in every country globally. And no one's being taxed on this. Everybody's being exploited. So foreign governments are open to AI and tech governance more so than the United States government. But I had stopped advising the government because they're not doing anything. And it back then I researched why is this taking place. Well, I personally think, I can't prove this, but I've been told that the foundation for the TikTok ban was the research that I gave the government associated with tech-based hybrid warfare, and how foreign governments can conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens through their phones and their computers through these apps, that was a national security threat. So in 2020, the Trump administration started with a new law started underneath them called the Protecting Americans from Adversarial Controlled Applications Act, which was to ban all these intrusive apps developed by ByteDance, Tencent that develops WeChat, ByteDance develops TikTok. You have Temu, Shein, and you just have a ton of Alibaba, Kuen, DeepSeek AI. They're all surveillance platforms. Again, like Google, Apple, Microsoft, all these companies from China are simply data brokers, and they're able to surveil us on our phones. It's the biggest national security threat that needs to be dealt with. But because Google, Apple, and Microsoft are making billions and trillions of dollars of profits, they're fighting this. And the Protecting Americans from Adversarial Controlled Applications Act is what's being, we're told it's the TikTok ban, and Trump is going to save the First Amendment and save TikTok. It has nothing to do with that. The app is meant to ban all apps and platforms that present a national security threat to the United States from all adversarial nations, not just China. And that app has been put on the back burner by the Trump administration. Why? In 2020, they were going to ban TikTok, and then the Biden administration took over, and the law actually got passed in the Biden administration. It was challenged, and the Supreme Court upheld it in at the beginning of the Trump administration, saying this is law. You need to follow the law. Well, they're not enforcing it over the TikTok ban. And so why is that? Well, I did a bunch of research. Trump had one of his former advisors is a guy named David Urban. If you ever watch CNN, he's the Republican contributor on CNN. His name is David Urban. He's a very powerful man. He founded a company called American Continental Group, which was the Trump Corporation's lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. So who became ByteDance's chief lobbyist after they were threatened to be banned? David Urban. David Urban was ByteDance's chief lobbyist. They hired American Continental Group. And then David Urban not only was hired as their chief lobbyist, this is a former advisor to the president, now working for a Chinese company beholden to the CCP. He also was hired by ByteDance as their senior vice president of North American operations. And the guy has no social media background, no tech background at all. So he worked directly for ByteDance for a while. And then I went and dug a little bit deeper. There's a guy named Jeffrey Yass. And Jeffrey Yass founded SIG, which is another investment company. And Jeffrey Yass, along with another Chinese investor who was a real estate broker in China, they started ByteDance way before TikTok. And Jeffrey Yass owns 26% of ByteDance. So it's 26% owned by a single American and his investment company, SIG. SIG owns 15%. Jeffrey Yass owns 11% of ByteDance. Well, they became donors to the GOP. And Jeffrey Yass was one of these guys who went to Mar-a-Lago last year and ate dinner with Donald Trump, lobbying for not just that TikTok doesn't get banned, but lobbying not to have the Protecting Americans Against Adversarial Controlled Applications Act even passed. Well, it was challenged in the Supreme Court, and there was nothing they could do. So they made up this story that it's the TikTok ban has nothing to do with TikTok. It's all apps that present a threat to us. And now that can has been kicked down the road. So it all boils down to what? It all boils down to money. It all boils down to hiring these K Street law firms, because Baidu has their own K Street law firm. Huawei, it's not a Republican or a Democrat problem. Huawei hired Tony Podesta, the brother of John Podesta, to be their chief lobbyist. And now there's nothing wrong with Huawei. Tony Podesta was a former presidential advisor to Clinton and Obama. So they're hiring former presidential advisors from both sides of the aisle and former elected officials. Trent Lott was also hired by ByteDance as one of their chief lobbyists. So they're hiring former elected officials through these K Street law firms. And that's why we're not seeing anything happen. We don't ever see these laws come to fruition to protect consumers. And this is why we need an electronic bill of rights, because not only are we getting hit from Google, Apple, and Microsoft and their partnership with all these app developers. But now you got to look at what's going on and where the money is. And again, it's the money, it's the influence as well.
So, what can people do right now to protect their digital autonomy? Are there any tips that you can give the audience today?
You can't unplug. One of the things that I teach this, I use Apple, but I also have there's other technology out there. It's Linux based. I teach a hybrid approach to data. So if I need something that's confidential and protected, I work off of a laptop that's supported by a what's called a Debian Linux operating system. Now, there's a company that manufactures these products. Some are made in America. It's called Purism. And they manufacture laptops, servers, even a smartphone called a Liberty phone that's supported by a Linux Debian OS called Pure OS. Now, if you want to get completely off the grid and completely away from this, you can buy those products and use that operating system. You don't have to click on, I agree to use the operating system, I agree to use the apps. It's built on a closed API architecture with open source coding so that all of the code can be audited at any time. So it's an auditable OS and the apps can be audited. And you can get a Librem key so that if there's any manipulation of the code or the apps, I can plug my Librem key in and see a snapshot of it, and it will expose any anomalies in the code to where I know that it's been compromised. And that's the most securest forms. Now, that takes a whole learning curve. It's still point and click, it's still easy to use, but it's a learning curve. You're also communicating with other people on unsecure devices, but it's the closest thing you can do. The other thing is I use Apple because Apple allows you to configure the iPhone for privacy. Now, this is configured to what's if you looked at Linux OS and Purism products, they're called decentralized products. There's even decentralized social media platforms like Mastodon and so forth. So there's technology out there and platforms out there that you can utilize that aren't supported by surveillance capitalism or targeted advertising. They're just not popular, and there's a learning curve. I can button this down to where it's a decentralized phone because when I first buy it, I don't buy it activated. I buy it as itself. And then there's two ways you can privatize this. One is through the privacy settings. That's laborious and it's going to reset. There's a way you can get into the system on Apple and shut it down at the system level. So no matter how many updates I get or how many new apps I put down, download to this phone, those system settings will never change ever. But I still had to click on I agree to use iOS, and in Apple's terms of service, they can share my data with anybody they want to, including the government. But at least it's only one company exploiting you and not 50 or more companies, including companies from China exploiting you. So there's a hybrid approach to all of this that I teach as well. And I teach that in my sessions. I taught this in Rabat, Morocco at the 2025 Regional Cybersecurity Week, where I was a guest of Smart Africa, and I did a 3-hour security session for over 40 African nations for security ministers for 40 African nations, and plus EU member nations from Europe. And I teach a hybrid approach to those governments. And I teach this hybrid approach to defense contractors and enterprise businesses through my company, My Smart Privacy.
So, where can we find your work, Rex, for people who are interested in learning more about what's going on in data, all of the tech journalism that you've done over the years? Where can we find your work to connect with you?
So the easiest way is to go to My Smart Privacy, www.mysmartprivacy. If you go under news and events, you'll see all of the trade shows that I speak at. I also, as a journalist, I get a press pass. So I cover South by Southwest, CERAWeek. I cover all these tier one conferences all over the world as a tech journalist. And then also on there are my articles and interviews, and they're pretty up to date. So for 2025, you can go all the way back through the archives and see all of my latest interviews and my latest articles. I write for publications like Tech Talk Summits. I write for websites like Purism's News and Events. I'll write articles for them and other publications that reach out to me for an interview or an article.
Well, thank you so much. This was such an informative episode, very much needed. I am so thankful to have come across your work and having you agree to be on the show because I actually want to invite you back for a part two. I have so many more questions that I think would give a lot of more educational insight into this. If you could leave our audience with one piece of wisdom today about everything you've taught us when it comes to protecting your rights online or at least learning about them, what would you leave them with?
Well, I've developed a website. I'm starting a nonprofit movement for an electronic bill of rights. This is like drinking water from a fire hose. Even in the limited time that we discussed today, it's like drinking water from a fire hose. It's too much for people to process. But if you want to learn about what's needed in new legislation, you can visit www.electronicbillofrights.com. And the framework that I wrote for a congressional policy A change proposal is there, plus an executive summary on why we need an electronic bill of rights. So everything is neatly put together there. Some of these, the layers of surveillance that you don't see are addressed in the articles. And it's written from a app and platform developer's perspective, plus other industry experts and people that I talk to that have also provided me ideas for articles or and so forth that need to go in there. All of that's compiled in there. And if you yourself work in tech and you want to contribute to it, or you see an article that needs to be written for it, you can reach out to me on the website and I'll be happy to research it. And if the article's validated, then I'll upload it as one of the articles in the Electronic Bill of Rights. So everybody can contribute to this, much like the Constitution and the Bill of Rights 250 years ago.
Well, Rex, thank you so much for your leadership, your courage, and truly your commitment to public safety. And for our audience, this conversation is not fear-based. It is very empowerment-based. Technology isn't the enemy, it's unregulated power. And I would say that we all deserve informed consent, data ownership, freedom of thought, even the right to disconnect when we want to, and sovereignty over our identities and our decisions. Maybe even if we cannot remove ourselves from the system, at least through intellectual awareness. And this is why I see that an electronic bill of rights is not just a luxury, it's a civil rights evolution. So thank you so much for watching Tailored Healing TV today. Make sure you subscribe and share this episode because knowledge is not power, applied knowledge is. So let's remember that. And thank you, Rex, so much for joining us on the show today. I hope that we can have you back for another episode.
Definitely, Taylor. Thank you for having me on.